KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thanks for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on two repeat guests who have not appeared together but are today to discuss a topic that we have not spent a lot of time on in Hearsay Culture, but it is time that we did. And that focus is robotics. I'm excited to have on today Professors Ryan Kahlo of the University of Washington School of Law and Woody Hartzog from the Cumberland-Sanford School of Law, both of whom have been among the leaders thinking about and writing about robotics from a legal perspective and also from a technological perspective. You know, we're hearing a lot about robots today, increasingly in ways that people have not only not thought about but not really considered. You know, I think, when I think about, at least recent exposure to robotics, there was the Watson computer that was on Jeopardy a few years ago that defeated at this point, the greatest human Jeopardy champion. But that really, was more along the lines of artificial intelligence, which is something else we'll get into a little bit today. But as we think about robotics over the last couple of years, I have thought a lot about drones and unmanned aerial vehicles, but we are even moving beyond those to human look-like models that actually do things that human beings seem to do. There was an article, and we're recording this show on May 8th. There was an article about a week ago involving the president who bowed to a Japanese robot, and while there were some humorous and snarky comments about it, it also was very interesting to see those kinds of interactions. And we go forward from there. So we have a lot of pop mainstream views of robots, but the real question is, what are these things? What are they doing now? What are they capable of? What are they not capable of? How does the law deal with it? What should we understand? And with both Woody and Ryan, we've got two people who have been at the forefront already in thinking through those issues, certainly from a law perspective, but even beyond that. So I'm very excited to have both of them on the show today. Like I said, I've had Ryan on talking about privacy issues as well as Woody. Woody was also on talking about some of these issues a little bit with Fred Stutzman a few years ago, but I'm excited to have both of them here to focus on robotics. By way of very brief background, Ryan researches the intersection of law and emerging technology with a current emphasis on robotics and the Internet. He's already a prolific scholar. He's on the board, the advisory board of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, as well as the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Future Privacy Forum, the National Robotics Week. He's involved heavily there. He is a co-founder of the We Robots conference that I think is in its third or fourth year now that focuses on scholarship in this area. He's joining us via Skype from his office at the University of Washington. Woody Hartzog joined the Cumberland faculty in 2011. He focuses heavily on privacy but also on robotics as well. He has been published in a number of law reviews including Columbia and California. He has his PhD in mass communication from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he is joining us via Skype from his office in Birmingham at the Cumberland School of Law. So, gentlemen, thank you for taking the time today to join us on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having
us. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let me start with you, Ryan. I've asked these questions of both of you who were on the show previously, but perhaps you could talk a bit more about your background, but more specifically why you have started to focus over the last few years, or maybe even longer, you can correct me on that, on robotics.
Well, sure. So, I've been interested in robotics for a long time. There's an interview with me that Microsoft did on its website, for the TAP website, and you can see a picture of me with like a robot that's about the same height as me, and I'm about 6 years old. And you have to understand that I grew up in the 80s, during the first big robotics craze. Robots were, if not a huge part of my life, there was something that held a great amount of fascination. We parted ways, robots and I, for some time, and I got into, I investigated allegations of police misconduct for a while. I did undergraduate major in philosophy. I was pretty far away from robots for a time, and then I ended up, graduating and then working in D.C. for a regulatory firm. It was really in D.C. at Covington and Burling that I started to think about technology in earnest again. And I did a lot of work that faced the Federal Communications and Federal Trade Commission, and a lot of the issues I was thinking about were around technology. And then I had the opportunity to go join, at the time, Larry Lessig and Lauren Gelman, at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society. And there I started working on internet law issues and privacy. And then, you know, all of a sudden, like, the 80s came back. It was back to the future, in more ways than one. And all of a sudden I started looking around me and seeing my old friends, the robots again. And over time, I came to believe that actually this was really going to happen this time, that for a variety of reasons we can get into, that this was going to be the next transformative technology of our time after the internet. So I started to sort of look around and, ended up co-founding a group at Stanford to look at driverless cars, wrote some stuff about drones, and we were off to the races.
Woody?
Well, so privacy and surveillance actually led me to robotics. I was attending an event actually with Ryan, and we were actually talking about something very privacy related about the design of technologies, and as part of that conference I had the good fortune to sit next to Greg Conti, who's at the United States Military Academy, and he and I over a conversation started talking about surveillance being everywhere. So everything is a sensor now, and it increasingly began to be automated. And then we started talking about how cars are now increasingly automated, and all of these things began to be increasingly automated, and of course robots are automated as well. And we began to kind of hash out the problems that can arise. And some of these problems we recognized were capable of being dealt with under current legal regimes. But there were a whole host of new problems that we didn't know how the law was going to react. So I started to become a little borderline obsessed about poking at all of these different holes. And when we started thinking about drones and automated cars, it became really apparent that the future was really now, and the time to start thinking about these issues was now. And so I was fortunate enough to become involved in the We Robot conferences early, and have been kind of riding that interest ever since.
You know, my focus, and of course Hearsay Culture's focus on what I do, has been information access across the board. And I think there's some serious information access issues here writ large, because there seems to be, as I mentioned in the introduction, I think a fair amount of misunderstanding as to what we mean when we say robots. And so I like asking definitional questions up front, because we don't do that enough, I think, when we're talking about, a lot of issues, and then we don't quite know what we're saying. So Ryan, I'll come back to you, and although I'm going to ask the same question of you, Woody, you know, when we say robot today, what do we mean? What is a robot?
Well, you know, there's no consensus definition of a robot, you know, with respect to, say, the Internet. Even the Supreme Court has sort of confidently defined the Internet in its decisions, whereas with robotics, it's more difficult. There is a working definition a lot of us use that I have sort of tweaked to my own purposes. And that definition suggested that a robot is a mechanical, roughly mechanical device that has three properties: that it is able to sense the world around it, that it is able to process what it senses, and so another information that it comes into contact with. Think about it in we would say in human parlance, but process that information and then act on that information in the world. This is basically based on an old paradigm called the sense think act paradigm, which initially was actually applied to people. It was about defining what it was for a person to have intent, and that's been sort of co-opted over the years by roboticists. I think what's useful about the definition is what it excludes. So, for instance, my laptop can sense the world if it has a camera on it, and it has certainly a great deal of processing capability, but it doesn't act on the world, right? It provides information, but it doesn't act physically, at least, on the world. Whereas a remote control car with a camera on it senses the world through the camera and acts on the world. It drives around in the world, but it's not really doing any processing. I think it's important to notice that all these things exist on a spectrum, and so you could have a robot that does but little processing, does but little sensing, and so forth. And there's also a really interesting border question we maybe will discuss today about whether or not, you know, a bot, like a software bot, which is just incorporeal, whether that might qualify as a robot as well. And so, you know, just sort of cribbing from if not a consensus, then a plurality of people that have used this definition to be useful, that's how I end up defining it in my work.
Woody, do you have a different definition, or do you want to add any granularity there?
Sure. So I think that Ryan's definition is a very good one. It's one that I adopt as well. And the question of the software bot, I think, is really getting at the heart of one of the most interesting questions. Because when you think about some of the things that we would consider to have a lot of the same issues as robotics, it really is things like software bots. So is Samantha in the movie Her a robot? And that's an interesting question because there are a lot of issues that Samantha does that seem like robotics issues, yet she's really just an AI bot. And so we have to ask that question. Now, what I will add about this definitional question that I tend to prefer is that it actually may not be that critical to define precisely what a robot is. So you really need to know kind of why you're asking, in the same way that because I came to robotics from privacy law, I see that the term privacy has never been really adequately defined, nor I think will it ever be adequately defined. And so you really have to think about for what kind of privacy you're talking about, or for what purpose do you need to define the term privacy, and can you have a more granular definition? And so I think that the best approach when we're talking about these definitional questions is to recognize that we're probably going to have multiple definitions of the term robot, and I think Ryan's observation that it's on a spectrum is spot on, and we should probably just embrace that and accept that and then say, okay, generally what we mean when we talk about a robot is something that is mechanical, that can sense, process, interact, but really specifically what we're talking about is blank or blank, because there's certain degrees of abstractions, even pieces of software or robots. So, you know, the software that runs the local power plant, that, you know, shuts off the power in cases of some, the odds that it senses something, you know, some kind of irregularity or some kind of overflow, then it cuts off power. Or technically, it sensed, it processed, and interacted. Yet we wouldn't consider that piece of software a robot. And so I think that's all, asking what a robot is maybe only the first or second along a series of questions that we need to ask when we're kind of getting into this discussion.
Well, yeah, and so I'll push on it by saying, you know, we at least traditionally think that semantics matter. And I guess my impetus for asking the question is that, you know, is that robot itself, I think, you know, and I'm thinking about it not from, you know, the standpoint of people who are immersed in the policy questions, but really just the average person who might be thinking or interacting about these things. You know, I have these images that come from movies, right? I mean, is a robot an automated arm that puts roofs on cars on an assembly line? Now, based upon Ryan and your definition, I think the answer is no. But I think that is in the public's mind today, hence the question. Now, I guess I'll come back to you, Woody, and maybe, you know, Ryan, see if you have any thoughts. I mean, from a policy perspective, do you see a disconnect today between the way that how we're defining robots, or how you're defining robots within the community, and the public's perception of them? Or am I making, you know, too much of that issue or of that question? Woody?
My sense would be that we're too early on to see any kind of a real disconnect, because we really haven't had any need for an omnibus, at least policy-based approach to robots yet. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, specific legislation about automated cars, and we have specific legislation about drones, but we haven't had, you know, the great robotics law of 2016 yet or whatever, at which point then it would become really critical. Now, I think that a lot of times when you say robot, we tend to think anthropomorphic robots, so one that has human characteristics, and at which point maybe that conceptualization of a robot is too myopic or narrow, whereas, you know, if we were to kind of expand it and say, you know, all software is a robot, then that would be way too broad. And so I think that there probably is an accurate consensus that a robot lies somewhere in between, you know, the Danger Will Robinson anthropomorphized robot and the, you know, all mechanical things that process instructions.
Ryan, do you want to agree with Woody, or what's your take on that semantical question?
Well, actually, you know, I actually do have a counter example. So one of the things I worry about is that we are attacking this problem piecemeal. And so, for instance, in the area of drones and privacy, you know, most of the states which have acted here have pegged their definition of a drone to the Federal Aviation Administration's definition of an unmanned aerial system. An unmanned aircraft system. That's a pretty narrow definition, and it encompasses things that, you know, fly and are mechanical and so forth. Whereas, of course, you know, surveillance technology comes in many, many different flavors, including robots. And so now there are robots that can climb the side of a building. There are robots, in fact, that Google purchased that can jump, you know, 30 or 40 feet in the air and land on top of a roof. There are robots under development at MIT that use a technique to squeeze underneath doors in order to get inside of buildings. There's robots that you throw into a room and they take a 360 degree a picture of the room so that you have some situational awareness. The truth of the matter is that if we expend too much political capital on the robot of the day, and we don't approach the problem of robotic surveillance more holistically, I worry that police are just going to say, okay, fine, flying is a hassle, let's just climb the side of this building or something. And so I do think definitional issues matter already, although I certainly agree with Woody that the issues have hardly come to a head. Precisely because we've been able to get away more or less with a sector specific approach, but again, I think that at least privacy law is the poorer because you know, lawmakers really haven't seized the moment here, the policy window to sort of crib from Priscilla Reagan that drone surveillance creates.
Woody, you know, I wasn't intending to do this like a briefing schedule where we have point, counterpoint, reply, but in light of Ryan's opinion, do you want to add anything before I move on to another question?
Oh, no, I think that I was speaking descriptively, not normatively, and I do think that has been, if we're pulling any lessons from the way the privacy law is created, it's that the patchwork, there are advantages and disadvantages to any kind of a patchwork approach, and one of the disadvantages is when you kind of have this organic bottom-up patchwork, things become entrenched, and it's hard to kind of shape the direction of it. Whereas now we are in the early days of robotics, so at least robotics and policy, and so, you know, it is, I think, perhaps normatively desirable to see how far we want to cast it, and that's the point of a lot of these research issues that we've been talking about, which is what are the issues brought up and how far do we want to cast this net?
We're chatting with Ryan Kaler of the University of Washington School of Law and Woody Hartsog at Cumberland School of Law on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So Ryan, you know, again, these kind of, you know, top-level questions I think are important as at least certainly on Hearsay Culture we've been beginning the discussion. You wrote not too long ago that robotics is the new internet law. And I think for many listeners of Hearsay Culture who are themselves focused on internet law and technology law, that will both resonate and and be somewhat shocking. So I want to ask you about that, and maybe you could talk about it a little bit more. What did you mean by making that point, and what does that mean for where internet law is or will be?
Right. So it's not. I mean, when I say that. Internet is robotics is a new internet law. I guess I just mean, you know, for me. I mean, the way that I structure the argument, and this is from a forthcoming paper in California Law Review entitled "Robotics and the New Cyber Law." And what it says is that not that the internet, you know, is going to go away as an issue somehow, or that the folks who are listening who study internet law are in any way less important. They're, you know. But rather just to say that the character of internet law may well change in light of the ascendance of this new transformative technology, because it can hardly be lost on anyone how the very same institutions that both private and public that catalyzed the internet have turned towards robotics, such that, for instance, having, you know, launched the commercial internet, or having, you know, fostered the commercial internet, the Defense Department soon turned to the DARPA Grand Challenge and began to catalyze robotics. And the companies that are household name internet companies are spending literally billions of dollars now on robotic technology for a complicated set of reasons. And then people like Woody and I and Michael Frumkin and even now David Post and Tim Wu and a bunch of other people are now starting to sort of write about these issues. And sometimes in the case of Tim, I think not self-consciously about the fact that this is really a change. In other cases, recognizing that it's part of a distinct set of differences. So, you know, I do frame it sometimes a little contentiously and say, oh, you know, or not contentiously, but, you know, I'm kind of being a little colorful in saying that robotics is the new internet, and I don't really mean that precisely. What I mean is that you know, robotics raises a bunch of interesting early questions, just in the same way that cyber law did 20 years ago. But in the intervening, you know, 20 years, you know, some of those questions from internet and cyber law have gotten answered, and even the ones that have not gotten answered per se. We kind of know what the moves are. You know, in other words, you know, that the 20 years of difficult thinking and writing and so forth by jurists and academics has yielded the kind of clarity and structure that one would hope. But now, even as, you know, even as the sort of waters have stilled a little bit, now here robotics comes to muddy it anew. And so, again, it's not a claim about the importance of robotics versus the internet, or a claim that internet law is no longer important. It's just an observation that the really muddy waters now are in this new space, and that if it turns out that the internet law community is the one to really dig in on this new issue, then that could well change the face of cyber law.
And Woody, you know, to play off of what Ryan just said, I'm curious to ask you, particularly as you're coming at this from the privacy side. You know, when I think about internet law and the arc that it's had, you know, the for me, you know, aside from the information sharing aspects of the internet that made it revolutionary, the other aspect of the internet that has become more apparent recently, which is why the privacy angle is so strong, is the pervasiveness of the technology that you pretty much can't opt out of the internet anymore, particularly with regard to issues like privacy. And I'm wondering whether you, again, recognizing we're early days, so I don't mean to ask a crystal ball question, but it sure sounds like it, right? I mean, well, do you see robotics having the same pervasiveness? You know, as we sit here today, again, it's early. I won't be interacting with a robot in the traditional sense, unless, as you pointed out, we're going to say that software and algorithms constitute robots. But I'm curious to get your perspective on that. I mean, are we looking at a time where like the internet, robots will become this pervasive aspect of society that we simply can't get away from?
I think so. I think that if we follow the arc that we're on, then I think that we're absolutely headed that way. And And that's, I think, for many reasons, a positive thing in that we'll be surrounded by robots, because I see immense potential in robots, just like I see immense potential, and of course, a lot of people saw immense potential in the internet. And so I think the really interesting question that Ryan and I have spoken about several times, and we spoke about it this year's We Robot conference, is to what extent is robotics going to become so pervasive in our lives and in law and policy discussions that it actually just kind of blends into other areas of the law, because it touches upon everything. And so we saw this debate with internet law. When the internet first came out, you know, it was internet law, and there were all these classes where people taught internet law, and we still do that because there are still a number of issues that are unique to internet law. But many of the things that were once taught in internet law classes have now been kind of co-opted by more traditional legal regimes. So the torts regime or contracts regime or property or all of these things where we would have kind of originally grouped them in the internet, when they become less novel, we wrestle with them, we figure them out, and then they kind of float into their respective categories. So I think that the really interesting question that we just don't know the answer to yet is, what part of robotics is going to be, you know, subsumed into its constituent parts of traditional areas of the law, and what part of robotics are really going to maintain a unique area where we will persist with a class of robotics law.
So let me ask you this one, and we're going to take a break in a moment, but, you know, we've kind of danced around, or I've danced around this question. I want to ask it now. So, you know, as it stands today, you know, there are a lot of conceptions about the capabilities and limitations of robots. And I know that this is by virtue of the fact that, you know, if we go off Ryan's definition, which we'll use, we have a pretty broad range of items and devices and things, that can constitute a robot. But with that understanding, you know, what are the limits, if any, at this point, of robots? And I want to separate that from artificial intelligence, unless you tell me that they shouldn't be separated. So I guess my question is, what are the limits of the technology as it stands today, and whether AI is part of that discussion?
So do you mean what are the limits with respect to the policy conversation we're having, or what are the actual...
No, I'm sorry. I mean the actual technical limits of robotics as it stands today.
That's a good question. I actually throw that one to Ryan, because I think that he's pretty on top of what's
fair enough, Ryan.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's what's really fascinating to me about this space is that, and sort of making a claim that robots are different and distinct, and you can draw lines around them, and in developing the argument of why I think that is, you know, the certain essential qualities that I think robotics display. I have had people on one side say to me, like Cory Doctorow, not directly to me, but on Point Blank and in The Guardian, saying about my paper that, you know, this is just computers, and there isn't anything specific, and therefore you can't have regulations related to robots because that doesn't make sense. You know, you're just talking about computers. And so there the claim, of course, is, you're overclaiming, you know, Ryan. You're saying that there's a there and there isn't. And then I've had people on the other side, like David Post, for instance, at We Robot and so forth, saying that when I claim that cyber law, you know, might have a lot to say about robotics law, and that some of the issues are conterminous, and that we don't necessarily need to sort of go our own way and have a whole new robot law. I get people like David Post saying, no, you do. You do, actually, and this is more different than you're saying. And so, I mean, I feel like I'm personally in a defensible place if two luminaries like Cory Doctorow and David Post are each telling me the opposite thing about where I'm sitting, right? I don't think that robotics is a complete break from what came before. I understand it has, previous and constituent technologies, that some of the questions that robots raise are functionally equivalent to the ones that the internet raises or computers raise. Nor do I think that it's such a sea change that, you know, we're going to have to sort of utterly rethink every aspect of the law or resuscitate slave law or something that, that people have toyed with. You know, I don't go that far either. And so I don't know if that's responsive to your question, but I feel like, you know, it's not a clean break, not a huge break entirely, but at the same time, there is something really novel going on.
We're chatting Woody, please go ahead. Yeah.
I'll go ahead.
Yeah, no, please, go ahead, yeah.
Well, I was going to add on that and just say I view this as kind of overlapping Venn diagrams when we're talking about intersections with other areas of the law. I mean, there are certain things that I think Ryan has identified that are probably really unique to robotics, and then there are lots of issues that are really important in robotics that are also important in other things, and AI is something that you pointed out. You know, AI can kind of exist, at least as we've conceptualized robotics, AI can exist independently of robotics, but certainly AI is a major component of robotics.
So I don't want to come right back to AI in a second there, Woody. We're chatting with Woody Hartzog from Cumberland School of Law, Samford University, and Ryan Kalo from the University of Washington School of Law on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to listen to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department and make a donation. You can donate by emailing our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or go to our webpage, that old internet technology, and click on donate to KZSU. That was a little throw at you there, Ryan. Click on donate to KZSU, and I know you didn't say that. This is my sense of humor, which some of the listeners I think appreciate from the feedback I get. Or you don't have to listen, I guess. You can turn off radio, and you can turn off podcasts in a way that perhaps you can turn off the internet writ large. Either way, we hope you continue to listen to KZSU. So let's talk about these. And again, you know, gentlemen, it's fascinating for me to hear this discussion because it really is very exciting to be talking about a technology which in many ways is new. We could debate how much, where you've got all these foundational questions that are being debated. Because certainly as compared to internet law, as you pointed out, Ryan, there are fewer and fewer of those questions, although they still exist. So Woody, you mentioned AI, and let's come back to it. You know, and also I think it ties into algorithms as well. But what is that relationship between artificial intelligence and our, you know, operating definition of robotics or robots in our discussion?
Well, I think that AI is something that is amplified when you have it within a robot. So there's Watson, and the debate is Watson a robot? And, you know, there's several things that can turn on him. I mean, you can say, is Watson embodied? Well, I mean, he's in a box, I guess, so he's sort of embodied. Does he interact with the world? Well, I mean, not really, unless, at least not in the physical sense, but certainly, you know, there's an interaction that happens with Watson. And so I think I'll put it this way. It's fair game, I think, to talk about AI and in the robotics discussion. And I don't know if Ryan agrees with me about that, but that would be my take on when we're having this discussion about robots. I think that it's completely fair to have AI included in that.
Ryan?
Yeah, I agree. I agree exactly for the reasons that Woody says. I mean, I struggle with this question sort of out loud in my paper, and I say, you know, that really anything that's organized to act upon the world, tends to qualify under sort of the act component of sense, think, and act. So for instance, I don't know that I would want to say that a smart home that where you walk in the door and it opens the door for you and turns the lights on and asks you a question, or you can ask it a question, what's the weather, and it, as in the case of the Microsoft's Home of the Future, you put some ingredients on top of the table and suddenly Grace comes on and says, it looks like you're trying to bake a cake. Can I project a recipe for you? That's a system that is organized to act upon the world. Similarly, a trading algorithm, is organized to act upon the world. And there I'd say the difference is that it's not just merely providing information. And it's not like it's entirely, you know, new kinds of question. I mean, we certainly, a lot of ink has been spilled over the question of when, speaking is acting. You know what I mean? I mean, when you make a threat or you make a contract or, and so forth. I mean, we've sort of thought about that question a lot. And so I think, and also, you know, when you provide information, you can do so with the hope of physically affecting the world. So, for instance, unfortunately, there have been attacks on websites for epileptics that involve, you know, causing the screen to flash in a certain way in the hopes of triggering an epileptic fit. So again, you know, there's this line between information and sort of physicality or action. And that's why I say it exists on a spectrum. But I completely agree with Woody that, you know, some of the essential qualities of robotics overlap entirely with those of artificial intelligence, and it definitely makes sense to have the conversation at the same time. And I personally, I mean, this may be idiosyncratic, but I personally use robotics to refer to both, you know, physical robotics and artificial intelligence. Some people are more specific, but that's what I mean when I talk about, you know, the prospect of robotics law. I mean also to include trading algorithms or the like, and some of the work that Woody's been doing around automated enforcement through algorithms and so forth.
And that's what I want to come back to in a second here, Ryan. But the segue really is, you know, I attended last year the NYU's and Princeton's Drones and Aero Robotics conference, which again, I mean, this is the contracts professor in me. Well, you know, you said drones and aerial robotics. Maybe there's something different, but I'll skip that one because I think we've worked with semantics quite a bit here. But one of the interesting things out of that conference, I want to ask really both of you about before I get to algorithms, was that at that conference, Chris Wong incredibly brought together both industry as well as academics to talk about drones, and it was very interesting to see, you know, some of the tension there as you had hobbyists as a smaller group, but you really had others that are trying to commercialize drones, painting the picture of all the benefits of drones, and then at the same time you had some academics and also activists who were concerned about, you know, the drones as are often seen on television, firing weapons at civilians in other countries. And so my question really is, you know, with regard to robotics, again, recognizing the vagary of the term, what is the state of the interaction between the academic community and those that are focusing on robotics as a field? What is the state of that interaction in these early days, Ryan?
There's enormous overlap between industry and academia, just enormous. Such that the major academics are going into industry, such that academics are spinning off startups. I would say that they are in constant conversation, and truly holding hands here. And I don't know, I gotta say I don't know the history well enough to say how true that was, in the past of say the internet. But I bet you did see significant overlap there as well. But I can just tell you that, I mean, you know, I've now had the, good luck to have worked in two places where robotics is extremely serious pursuit, one Stanford and one University of Washington. And at both Stanford and the University of Washington, folks have left to go to major industries. For instance, our big roboticist at UW, or one of them, I should say, gosh, one big roboticist at UW went to be the chief technology officer at Nest. Sebastian Thrun, famously at Stanford in artificial intelligence, went to lead the driverless car effort at Google. And you could just tell, you know, one story after another. And then we have some awesome startups here, like Blue Haptics, as an example, that come out of our labs at the University of Washington. So I would say there's a tremendous amount of overlap there.
So I'm going to ask, in light of that answer, Ryan, and Woody, I'm going to ask you this, and this is kind of a tough question, but I think it's important. There's been some concern raised with regard to academics doing analysis of, for example, the financial industry and issues of disclosure and understanding those relationships. And to be clear, I'm not suggesting that Ryan's suggesting anything pernicious about this, but I want to ask this question because I think it's an important one. Is there reason to be concerned about too much overlap between the academic community and the robotics community, given the fact that, as we've seen quite clearly here, we're in early days and we're going to need some non-emotional, non-vested, fact-based analysis of what these things mean? Not that that's not possible by one that has those interests, but clearly history has shown that there could be issues. Again, is that an issue? Is that a concern? Is that something to think about? And Woody, perhaps I'll ask you that one.
My guess would be probably not more so than in any other discipline in any other kind of field. One thing that robotics has going for it is that it's an incredibly exciting area to participate in, and that's going to draw lots of different people from I think a very broad cross section. And David, I think that you probably experienced this just at the drone conference alone, given how many different kinds of people and how many different voices are already in this phrase. So we're seeing civil rights organizations, we're seeing industry, we're seeing academics, we're seeing lots of different people, even in these very early days, getting involved. And so I think to the extent that we have worries about that, it's probably no more so than we have worries about that generally. Now that's just my reaction and I would defer to Ryan on that.
Yeah, Ryan, I'll ask you the same question. Is that a legitimate issue, or is that an issue that not worth thinking through?
I don't think it's an issue that's worth thinking through yet. And so, you know, like Woody said before, I think that the time is now to start to puzzle through some of these legal and policy issues, because, you know, this technology is upon us. And I think there may come a time when we want to ask ourselves, are these two places too close? But remember that the close tie between roboticists and industry is largely a product of the fact that there are some really difficult problems to solve, you know, both in terms of, you know, basic things that robots still can't do, as well as doing the things that robots can do, but with at a much lower price point. And so when I say that industry and academia are holding hands, I mean they're holding hands to try to like solve difficult problems. It's not like where we are with the internet, you know, where there, you know, you might, or you know, intellectual property in general, where people ask questions about where does the money come from and where does this person come from and so forth. I think that's overblown too, but let me set that aside for a moment. You know, I don't think it's like that. I don't think it's like the so-called revolving door between agencies and industry and then the danger about capture. I think these folks are just trying to roll up their sleeves together, and it takes these multi institutional partnerships to solve these hard questions. So I don't think we're at a point where we should be worried about that yet, honestly.
And can I jump in and add that in some ways, because robotics, academics get into robotics is largely a matter of design, which involves, you know, weighing some really difficult issues, there actually may be some structural roles for academics to play a part in industry, such that when, you know, for example, Pat Lin has written extensively about the ethical implications of Pat Lin and others actually have written about the ethical implications of automated cars and how you're going to have to design software to make certain decisions that have ethical implications. And so in a way, the close relationship between industry and academics is something to be encouraged, particularly to the extent that that these ethicists and philosophers and policymakers and other disciplines can help inform these software decisions and design decisions for the better.
And that, you know, and that gets us, and I've been promising I was going to ask about algorithms, Woody, and now I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it in what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking questions and you don't have time to answer the questions adequately, particularly since these are complex questions, but then I ask the question anyway. So here we go. You've written extensively about algorithms, and I think this is a perfect, potentially a perfect example of what both you and Ryan have just described. When we think about algorithms, when we think about, you know, code that had, that creates decision-making processes inside devices, what is the current role of algorithms in automated law enforcement today, as an example of robotics?
Well, that's, you know, the answer to your question is something that I think will resonate, unfortunately, all too well with you, Dave, which is that we don't exactly know. And the reason why is that so much of automated law enforcement is outsourced to third-party vendors who claim proprietary interests over the algorithms and the other kind of guts of code mm-hmm. that go into things like red light cameras and license plate readers speeding drones and things of that nature. And so that's a really disconcerting aspect of a regime that relies upon algorithms that are essentially legal determinations, right? So whether a car has actually ran the red light or whether a car is actually speeding and how many times to issue a speeding ticket within any given trip, all of these things, when they're translated into code, are essentially legal judgments. And inherently, this is a place where it's potential for bias to creep in, for unfairness to creep in, particularly when you consider the financial incentives for automated law enforcement. And so I think that, which some of your work, David, actually sheds the light on, is the real need for transparency, because I wish that I could answer your question with a lot of really great details. But right now, unfortunately, all I can do is speculate.
And yes, I'm going to resist the caveat that I have on my show, which is that I ask questions and don't engage in answering questions, Woody. So I'm simply going to say that seems to be an issue that we could come back to in the future on a separate show, and something that I've talked about as you point out in other work. Let me ask you this, Ryan, and we're closing in again on maybe about 7 minutes left, and I want to ask you a few more questions. The case for robotics, I think being a positive force, I think people are, you know, thinking through and understanding, right? It's not just the ability to automate things like, you know, cleaning your floor, but right, it's the ability to make both devices more useful, create things we couldn't create before. I want to ask you, though, that, you know, the flip side question, and it resonates now because particularly as we're recording on May 8th, about a week ago or so, Stephen Hawking had an article where he posited that, and again, focusing on AI, but given the blurred lines here, I think it's a fair question, that he was concerned that the creation and invention of AI may prove to be the biggest mistake humanity's made because of the issue of singularity and machines begetting smarter machines. And he posited this frightening image of machines creating weapons that, as he wrote, human beings cannot understand. So this is radio, and so I'm asking you the hyperbolic question. But how real a concern is that? What's your take on, and again, I'm simplifying Hawking's point, but this notion that we are creating through robotics devices and mechanisms that will become smarter than us?
Honestly, I think it's a reminder that just because you're brilliant in a particular field of study does not mean that you appreciate the nuances of every other field of study. And every serious person I've talked to in artificial intelligence has said that the problems to achieve that level of intelligence are either far in the future or perhaps even insurmountable as a conceptual matter. One of my friends and colleagues, Marianne Williams, put it very well a few years ago. She said, you know, Ryan, we've been doing artificial intelligence since that term was coined in the 50s, actually at my alma mater. And now today, you know, robots are about as smart as insects. And so I think that those fears are overblown and misplaced. I know that some serious people hold them, and I don't think we can disregard that, but I think that if I had to name the particular fallacy at operation, it was the idea that merely because we'd have the processing speed to approximate something like intelligence, that would translate then in the ability to do so. And in fact, there's just as challenging a software problem as there is a hardware problem. I mean, we could have, you know, just absolutely, you know, human speed, so let's say processing, going on, brain-like speed of processing and still not be able to reproduce something like consciousness. You know, that said, I really, really believe that we're going to face some fascinating issues and some deep ethical dilemmas well short of the kind of nightmare scenario that Joy and you know, most recently Hawking have put forward. So, you know, I don't want to go on overly because I know we're at the end here, but I would really recommend the work of Herbert Simon, and particularly The Shape of Automation and of Men in Management, where he draws a distinction between how progressive you are about the technology, how far you think it's going to go, and he differentiates that between how much it's going to impact society. And Simon says, he's like Hawking. He thinks it's going to, you know, robots are going to do everything humans can do, but he thinks that the impact on the economy is going to be pretty modest, and that in fact it will not necessitate additional economic models. I find I have the opposite intuition as Simon, that I believe that the gains in technology will be modest. Things will get cheaper. We'll do a little bit more than we're doing now, but that it will have a huge impact on society.
And Woody, I'll frame the question slightly differently for you, which is that, you know, I am asking the pushback questions because I think they're helpful in defining what it is exactly we're talking about. But you know, I could ask the same question from that positive perspective that I've alluded to, which is, you know, the capabilities of robots. I mean, is there, you know, putting aside Hawking's point, you know, is there that countervailing story that perhaps isn't being heard, which is that these, you know, whatever we call robots, they are going to be they're going to be devices that we create as human beings, and that therefore we can shape them, you know, not to put this now in a theological light, but in our image. You know, what do you make of that countervailing point, if any of it, to this notion of robots being, you know, somehow apocalyptic?
Oh, I tend to agree with Ryan on a lot of these issues, which is that there will be some incredibly positive things that we'll get from robotics. I mean, we're already seeing early returns now, and if you just limit our discussion to things like anthropomorphic robots or which can provide, you know, potentially emotional support. We talk about caregiving robots. I think that's a very promising area. When we talk about drones are an incredibly useful technology. They can be deployed in a lot of really useful ways. And so I try to remain very positive on a lot of these issues. Even automated law enforcement, which I've written extensively about, has some incredible uses. I mean, one thing that it does is by removing discretion from kind of the cop on the beat, and we can get rid of a lot of really harmful things that come from discretion, like bias and police brutality and instances of like driving while black. And we have a lot of things that we consider to be negative aspects that robots can help solve. And so I do think that it's when we have this discussion about the drawbacks of robots and the threats posed by robots, we should keep in mind the advantages as well, so we can then properly weigh exactly how we want to design these things. Because a lot of these discussions where we talk about, you know, robots will signal the end of mankind, kind of have this assumption built into it that we're not going to affect the design of these robots as it goes, right? So like we're going to, you know, flip the switch on AI and it will just kind of run off to its own devices, and you know, that's the last part that we have to play in it. I mean, we'll be shaping this over time, and we'll be constantly shaping these technologies. And so you know, I've got confidence that you know, with the right amount of conversation and the right amount of effort that we can, you know, get to a good place on this thing.
You know, and you know, Woody Hartsog and Ryan Kalo, I mean, you both have written extensively here. I was going to ask you a question with regard to a research agenda, but I think, quite frankly, it's been covered in this discussion. There's a lot of work to be done. So I am going to ask you this closing question, both of you. And Woody, I'll start with you. You know, both of you are prolific in this space. Where can people go to find your current work? You know, where can they look at this point?
On robotics, I would point everyone to the archived websites for the incredible We Robot conference, which actually has copies of all of the papers that have been presented at that conference and videos of all the discussions, which the discussions were just incredible. And you can also go to my SSRN page, which has all of my articles.
Ryan?
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I mean, we are in our we're going into our fourth year for We Robot, and all the papers are up. Two sets are with Miami, one set's with Stanford. The next We Robot conference will be in Seattle, which is great. And then similarly on my SSRN page, I have a paper about robotics and privacy, actually more than one, and a paper about product liability, and then this new paper is not up because I'm revising it, but I will post that soon.
Ryan Kahlo, University of Washington School of Law, Woody Hartsaw, Cumberland School of Law. I mean, as listeners of this show know, I'm a fan of both of your work. Like I said, you've been on the show previously to discuss other topics. I'm thrilled that you came on today to talk about these issues. It's very exciting stuff. I mean, we're in early days, and these questions are fascinating and challenging, and exactly not only why I do the show to bring these issues to a wider audience, but also why I became a law professor to think about this kind of stuff. So thank you for your work. I look forward, obviously, you have almost a standing invitation, both of you, to come back on the show to discuss these issues. But thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Always
thank
a pleasure.
You so much.
Thank you.
So the remaining schedule on Hearsay Culture is one more guest for this quarter. Coming up next week is going to be Nabiha Syed of Levine, Sullivan, Koch, and Schultz, speaking of robotics on drone technology and freedom of information. I am in the process of booking guests for the summer schedule on Hearsay Culture and KZSU, which starts in late June. Among the guests that are already confirmed that I'll be having on include Professor Albert Meyer of the Utrecht School of Governance at Utrecht University on open data, Ivan Krastev, who had been previously scheduled to be on the show, but who I'm scheduling for the summer, from the Center for Liberal Strategies in Bucharest, author of In Mistrust We Trust, Can Democracy Survive When We Don't Trust Our Leaders? Professor Mark Fenster of Levin College of Law, University of Florida, on transparency issues. Jennifer Urban of the Berkeley Law School on intellectual property litigation and Berkeley's current clinical projects. And there's going to be a number of guests as well that I'm in the process of booking. This quarter, you've been able to listen to Hearsay Culture on KZSU's schedule Wednesdays, 2 p.m. Pacific time, by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can get all previously 210 previous shows by going to hearsayculture.com or by going to the CIS webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or by going to the iTunes page. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And again, I sincerely mean that if you have any suggestions for guests that should be on the show, please let me know. Otherwise, I look forward to chatting with you next week. So please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.